The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The following is a conversation between Greg Van Kirk, co-founder and president of Social Entrepreneur Corps, and Denver Frederick, host of The Business of Giving, on AM 970 The Answer in New York City.
The CEO of Warby Parker believes that the unique, immersive experience offered by Social Entrepreneur Corps is key to career success. Now that's a statement that grabs your attention. And tonight you will learn what makes that experience so special from Greg Van Kirk, a Shoko Fellow, Executive Director of Community Empowerment Solutions, the Skoll Foundation Social Entrepreneur of the Year in 2012, and the co-founder and president of the aforementioned Social Entrepreneur Corps. Good evening, Greg, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Good evening. Thank you, Denver.
Share with us the mission and objectives of Social Entrepreneur Corps.
Yeah, our mission is really to empower the leaders of the future. If you look at students from high school to college, university, young professionals, to be able to effectuate positive change in their lives and in the world through an experience in the countries where we work, such as Guatemala, Ecuador, the Dominican Republic, and Haiti, working on real projects with real people and real communities and tackling wicked, complex problems.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't you walk us through one of your programs? Who are these programs designed for? How long do they go on? What exactly do these participants do, and what are they going to walk away with?
Yeah, I'll try to unpack it here a little bit. We first started Social Entrepreneur Corps in 2005, and this is when I was living in Guatemala and leading our work there, our social innovation work in communities in Guatemala. You know, the original idea was really about, you know, how can we understood that we needed more people to do more of what we are already doing and to learn how to do new things. And we looked at the landscape and saw that students, in particular university students, were very interested in social entrepreneurship and this budding idea of social entrepreneurship at the time. And so we originally designed a program really with the thought of how can we work with university students in particular, mm-hmm. so that they can come down and help us to make a greater impact in what we do. Looking at that, then the question is, well, how do we build a really strong program? And as a Peace Corps volunteer, a former Peace Corps volunteer at the time, obviously had a bit of understanding about, you know, what made the Peace Corps tick and, yep. you know, and what worked really well. And so if you look at it, one of our signature programs, for example, right now is our 8-week program. So we have an 8-week program. We partner with different universities, although the program is open to any university student. We have projects that we set up before the program comes down. Those are social innovation projects where students design a social innovation, as well as consulting projects where they do consulting for small grassroots organizations typically. When students arrive, they stay with a homestay family. Obviously, this is all about triggering empathy and understanding, learn Spanish intensively, mm-hmm. learn about really what is it that makes social innovation, social entrepreneurship work. And then they get out in the field and work side by side with our team that's working in these countries year-round to help to design and develop social innovations and support other organizations with the idea that most certainly, you know, the desired outcome is to help these organizations and to help to create some social innovations. But at the end of the day, it's what the students take out of it.
Yeah.
And it's that they're able to develop their adaptive leadership skills, their empathy skills, to be able to thrive in uncertainty and all these things that are necessary, obviously, to succeed in the future.
Give us some examples of these social innovations that participants work on.
Yeah, so, you know, this summer in particular, we've had students come down and work with us in Ecuador, Guatemala, the Dominican Republic in particular. Two of the social innovations that we're working on right now, one is what we call El Colaborativo, so the collaborative. I think as you know, Denver, I mean, what we need oftentimes in this work is for organizations to be working together more often.
Mm-hmm.
People tend to think that maybe, you know, nonprofits and social sector organizations would work together really well, but there are a lot of challenges there, and which means there are a lot of opportunities. And so students are helping us to design ways whereby we can build collaboration between local organizations in the countries where we work so that they can, you know, leverage strengths, mitigate weaknesses. And at the same time, as we build up those local communities, those local networks of organizations, then that can be a platform for people people to support them virtually from, you know, from the United States or Europe. So that's one innovation they're working on. And the second is something that we call boxed impact, which briefly, it's about how do we get people in, you know, marginalized rural communities, things that we know that they need, that they need, that we've learned over time, some basic technologies such as reading glasses or solar lamps. And we've typically done that through the micro consignment model, which is a local model to empower women entrepreneurs to provide those things. But as well, students can take these things down in a small box and deliver them to, say, an education organization, which really knows their community best. And that organization can then decide in their own way how to distribute to their own constituency. So ideas that are sort of in the beta phase that we're trying to learn and having the student input and critical thinking is hugely helpful to us.
Well, one of the organizations you work hand in hand with is your sister organization, which is Community Empowerment Solutions. Tell us about CE Solutions.
Yeah, no, thank you. So CE Solutions, we started CE Solutions in May of 2004. You tend to remember these dates, right? when I was still down in Guatemala. And we had already started a variety of different initiatives. I started a local tourism initiative, an education project, had just started this micro consignment model that I had referred to previously. And we saw that some of these things were working, but that they really needed further development if we were going to create the impact that we wanted to and if we were going to be able to scale. And so that necessitated starting up a nonprofit organization as an administrative tool and as a way to obviously access some capital. And so with CE Solutions, that started in Guatemala. And then as we saw some of our work start to, you know, start to have a bit of success, we expanded that work to other countries in Latin America in particular, with the idea that we go in and try to work with people to create new social innovation, start new ideas, but then we step back after we help to set up social enterprises or other local organizations so that local people can take the lead.
One thing I'm going to ask you to expand upon is that micro-consignment model, which actually has its own Wikipedia page, about 10 of them, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
Describe for us what it is.
It's essentially a means to get people in what people would say the last mile, or oftentimes people might even say the first mile, right? To get people things, vital technologies, vital things that they need that exist, but they're not quite getting yet. So in many regards, it's a distribution mechanism, if you were to look at it through a business lens. And the idea is that we know that people need reading glasses, right? 95% of people in the world are going to need them when they're over 40, but 95% of people don't have them. We know that people need water purification solutions or solar energy solutions or a whole host of different things. We know that people need them. We know that people aren't getting them. And so the question is, how do you get something from here to there?
Yep.
And the issue isn't just about capital. So although microfinance, microcredit is an amazing tool, obviously, to use when somebody has a going concern and they need to be able to have more money to be able to buy more things, to sell more things. The issue is really about access and empowering new businesses, new entrepreneurs to be able to go out and sell these things. And so essentially the way that it works is, you know, we work with communities and find out what they need. We see if we can get access to these types of technologies. And then we identify women who go through a process of learning about the technologies and learning how to run a business. And then instead of asking them to invest money that they don't have to buy the products up front to sell them, or instead of simply offering them capital, because capital is necessary but insufficient, we actually bring in the products and we offer the products to them on a consignment basis, which means that they can test it and try it. And then once they go out to community and they sell something, they earn a profit. And then what comes back, we reinvest to help their business and help them grow.
All with no collateral.
All with no collateral.
You know, your program goes to a lot of different countries, or a number of them, Ecuador, Nicaragua, Dominican Republic. But you spent a significant amount of time in Guatemala.
Yes.
As you said, starting the Peace Corps there back in 2001. Not many Americans know much about Guatemala. Tell us about the country and what you find to be particularly interesting about it.
Yeah, I think, well, I consider Guatemala in many regards kind of a second home. It's a wonderful, diverse country. Wonderful people. I think you could probably say that about most countries. Yeah, I guess some of the things that people might not know is there are 22 different languages in Guatemala, and so 22 different what you'd say dialects. But these aren't, you know, it's not like, you know, I speak with a New York accent, somebody speaks with a Southern accent. These are entirely different languages. So you have all of these different communities, which obviously is one of the rich parts of the culture. but by the same time can create challenges in terms of communication and working together. There is, you know, I think a misconception about Guatemala is that it's this dangerous place that if I get off the plane, something bad's going to happen to me. We tend to, I think, unfortunately, paint countries with a very broad brush. There are dangerous parts of Guatemala, most certainly, but the majority of it isn't dangerous. And wonderful people who, just like you and I, care about our communities, care about our families, and just want to do our work. And I think apart from that is just incredibly welcoming, incredibly dignified, and incredibly receptive to working together and trying to build solutions together.
Greg, who are some of your partners and champions who help support this work, whether financially or otherwise?
Yeah, so we work with, you know, we have a variety, if you'll note, we have a variety of different organizations. I mean, the mission is the same for all of these organizations. It's really about, you know, how do we create systems changing social impact at scale? And you set up different organizations for different legal reasons or because of different geographies. And so within the different organizations that we've created, we work with a variety of different partners. As you referred to in the beginning, we work with Warby Parker. I've actually known Neil we worked together in El Salvador back when he was right out of college. So we're one of their partners for their Buy One, Give One program. When their employees finish 3 years, they come down to the field and get to see the impact of their work. Do work with Levi Strauss Foundation, who supports our work in Haiti, and we work as a strategic thought partner for their overall worker well-being initiative. We do some work with the IFC. We're currently doing an agricultural project in Haiti with them. And certainly with Social Entrepreneur Corps in particular, we partner with a whole host of different universities. So we have students from Duke, from Northwestern, University of Maryland, University of Connecticut. You know, I think that, you know, overall, I'm a big believer in partnership and collaboration, as I referred to earlier. And, you know, the more that we can find opportunities to work with people who share the same values and the same goals and objectives, the better it is for all of us.
One other organization we haven't talked about is CareerX.
Yes.
Which is really the first global internship and personalized leadership program out there. Tell us about them and how they differ from some of the other things that we've discussed.
Yes, yeah, so CareerX we've sort of done some restructuring. CareerX is a program much like Social Entrepreneur Corps under what we now call sort of Project X, which is this new partnership with a good friend and colleague, Jeff Hittner.
Yep.
And briefly, CareerX, what makes it a bit different is Jeff in particular has done a lot of work around purpose and mindfulness here in the U.S. Obviously, so much of my work in our area of focus has been internationally and in social entrepreneurship. And so what we decided to do in pilot this past year was, could we create a program that combines all of that? And so it's right now we're based out of New York. We have programs that are open to all different university students, which is a series of we have a series of workshops with mentoring where folks design their own social innovations, working in teams, where then they go down to, say, Guatemala and work on consulting and the same types of innovations that they're working on here in New York City. So, you know, at the end of the day, it's an effort that, you know, there are mentorship programs, there's study abroad programs, there are social venture competitions. The question is, how could we elegantly combine all of these things in a way that creates change and empowers students to survive, to thrive in this kind of VUCA world that we're going to be living in?
Got it. Let's turn our attention, Greg, to things that it takes to be a successful social entrepreneur. And it really all begins with empathy.
Yes.
First and foremost, you've led Ashoka's Start Empathy work here in North America. What does empathy really mean, and how do you get better at practicing it?
Yeah, well, I certainly agree wholeheartedly. I think empathy is at the heart and the foundation of everything. And I would say that, you know, it's looking at empathy as a verb, and it does take practice. And I know that when I'm not engaged with communities and with people, I lose it.
Yeah.
So it's something you have to keep at. But you know, when you look at empathy, there, I guess a couple of quick things, if I could. One is I've done some work with this really great guy, Chris Atkins, who's at William & Mary and is now at Notre Dame. And the way that he puts empathy is there are sort of three ways that you can get empathetic, let's say, or sort of trigger your empathy. One is you're naturally empathetic with say a family member, right? Something happens with your wife, your son, you know, what have you. So that's one trigger of empathy. The second is people who don't have the same backgrounds but have shared experiences. If you look at, say, Alcoholics Anonymous, right, people are naturally empathetic. And the third way is just simply physical proximity. And so if you think about empathy as a basis, how do we understand each other, work across difference? in particular when we're working in communities where we don't have experience, right? Those first two triggers of empathy, family member, shared similar experiences, aren't there. Mm-hmm. So you have to go and you have to engage and you have to learn about each other and how to work together. So you need that as a foundation to get understanding. But then as a second point, what I would say is, you know, we're in the innovation business and we're in the change business. And to innovate, you need to work as a team, mm-hmm. right? And when you're innovating, you need to be able to fail, right? It's all about continuous failure and improvement. And so if you think about it, if I want to innovate, I have to work as a team, which means I have to be able to fail. We have to be able to fail together as a team, which means that we have to forgive each other. Right? Which means that there needs to be trust. And below trust, before you get to trust, you have to have respect, mutual respect. And before you can have mutual respect, you need to have empathy. And so on so many different levels, if you think about creating change or simply creating understanding, we have to proactively seek out and work our empathy, or else, you know, we're not going to make the change that we need to in communities.
Let me pick up on one of those, and that would be trust. What's its role in social innovation, and how do you go about gaining trust?
I think it's critical to everything that we do. You know, if you look at, say, the micro-consignment model, which you referred to, and you said with no collateral.
Mm-hmm.
I believe in my experience and in having, you know, seen other social innovations around the world, you know, what really makes it tick is trust.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly we know that, you know, back to microfinance or so many other innovations are built on social capital, which is all about trust. So a group of people who trust each other and will do something together. So either you want to leverage that or you want to create it. But at the end of the day, you know, it's by entering with trust begets more trust.
It does. It's repaid all the time.
Exactly.
And trust in someone.
And it's something to be careful about, because we have a tendency, I think, inadvertently to try to create solutions where there is implied mistrust. If mm-hmm. I ask you, if I go to a community in Guatemala and I want to work with a community or work with an organization, and I say, well, you have to sign this big contract up front before we start to work together, there's implied mistrust there. And then we're already starting off the relationship sitting on opposite sides of the table.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the only way to really create change is to be sitting on the same side of the table. So that trust part, not just to be able to create innovations, but also to be able to trust, we don't have all the answers. And so, you know, a great phrase I heard someone say is, you know, make your problem someone else's opportunity. And the only way to do that is to really trust others and help them to thrive.
Yeah. And of course, if you want to scale, you're going to have to trust.
Exactly.
You're going to have to decentralize and delegate and things of that nature.
Exactly.
You know, as you think about the work of social innovation, you say it can really be hampered if we look at these communities from a poverty perspective, something that's pretty easy to do.
Yeah.
Why is that problematic?
Well, I think, you know, it's looking at something, you know, looking at a community or looking at an individual from a deficit perspective, from a poverty perspective, I think is very limiting. I think, you know, when you look at, in particular, for example, when you look at communities and you look at, you know, some of the types of communities that we work in, that we work with, excuse me, is the natural thing is to say, okay, well, this community is impoverished. And then the natural place to jump to then is to think about, when we think about poverty, what do we think about? We think about money.
No money.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the community has limited access to capital, has limited funds. Right? But if we just look at it through a money perspective, we're just going to provide a money solution.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas we need a whole heck of a lot more creativity to create change. But if you look at that community from more of an asset-based perspective, not from simply a deficit perspective, then what you can see is, besides economic capital, there may be a deficiency in economic capital, there's an incredible wealth in so many other forms of capital. If you look at human capital, amazing human capital, right? If you look at, you know, what I would say is experiential capital, all the different things that they know about their community, sort of institutional knowledge, right? Social capital, which we touched upon, this incredible social capital in community. So looking at it from an asset perspective and not a deficit perspective helps you work with communities in a very positive and powerful way, and helps them to then engage and come up with their own solutions, which is ultimately the way to really create change.
Great point. You know, I've always wondered why we have so much emphasis on a nation's GDP.
Oh, exactly.
And how that became the one and only measure in terms of ranking nations.
Exactly.
Final thing on this is that one of the challenges of this work is to be clear and stay clear about desired social outcomes, which can easily be lost. What advice do you have for gaining and maintaining clarity around these outcomes?
Yeah, I think oftentimes when we fail or when we confront challenges is when we start with resources. I have something. What am I going to do with it to make it work? Or we start with an activity, right? I can do this well. I know how to teach. How can I go teach? Which in the short term may provide a solution, but in the long term, you're going to oftentimes get off track. And so I think the first question you have to ask yourself is why am I doing this, and not why am I doing this for me or my organization, but what is the change that I hope to help create for the lives of the people that I'm working with? And if you can define that, and that's a process, it's harder than you would think. If you can really define that well, and then if you can really define, okay, how am I going to know if it happened? So what are my indicators of success? Then I think the rest can fall into place. And then what that means is if I stay true to my desired outcome, my indicators of success might change a bit. But then that means I can change what inputs I use. I can change what activities I do, as you'll need to because you're working in dynamic environments. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's having clarity around that, having clarity around what are your core values that drive your work. And then at the end of the day, that it's not about my thing. It's not about my social innovation, my tool. It's about creating change. And however that might happen, that's wonderful.
Yeah, that's a great distinction because we are somewhat self-absorbed. And we'll go to our board and say, we distributed 100,000 pairs of glasses.
Yeah.
Not thinking, well, how many people learned to read?
Exactly.
How many people were able to continue with their employment? It always is me and what we did.
Yeah, I think, the way we look at it, you get into the measurement, right? 100,000 pairs, that's an output. It's not an outcome.
That's right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can obviously, there are proxies you can know because you've done research. But, the way that we look at it, too, is just, we're in the change business. And what we're trying to work on is empowerment, is people helping people to become empowered in whatever way we can do it. And that's either going to be, by providing, helping people to have the ability, which is the knowledge and skills, helping people to have the means, the resources, and or helping people to have the incentive and the motivation. And the question is simply, where do we intervene?
Mm-hmm.
Where can we play the most positive role in that equation?
Greg, let me ask you about your organization itself. Tell us what it's like to work at Social Entrepreneur Corps. And in your mind, what makes a corporate culture exceptional and distinctive?
Yeah, well, it's... I think it'd probably be better to ask my team about that, but it's challenging. It's challenging because we work in a variety of different countries and we work on a variety of different projects with limited resources. I mean, I hope the culture is one where our team members feel empowered to be creative and to try new things, and to fail. We're just blessed with wonderful people all the time that frankly, I just goes back to the trust that I trust implicitly. Again, if we all sort of care about the same things and we're working towards it, then because we work in different environments as well, different countries, people need the freedom to be able to create and try new things.
Mm-hmm.
It's a culture of friendship, where people don't just value themselves as colleagues, but also as friends that are mutually supportive, and one of respect. And, one of the things certainly in this field, as you well know, and in particular when we're working internationally, we have very few people who stay for a long time besides our local team members, because people come in and they do this for 2 years, sort of like the Peace Corps, and then they leave. And so it's not to fight against that. It's to work with it. And so certainly, one of the big parts of this is, hopefully we can continually show that we're respectful of people who are going to have a transition and try to support them as much as possible in the future.
Let me ask you a little bit about your personal journey. After you got out of school, you went into banking, UBS, I believe. What led you to be doing this work?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think when I went into banking for about 5 years, and then I left, and I went into the Peace Corps, and I think people jump to the conclusion oftentimes when they hear about that. I became disenchanted or angry at capitalism and said, I'm going to
knee-jerk reaction.
Yeah, throw everything off and, put on a robe and sandals and go to Guatemala. and that wasn't really the case. I mean, I always knew I wanted to do this kind of work. I didn't really know what it was or where I could contribute. When I worked in banking, I worked with a wonderful team of people and it was an incredible education for me. But I guess the trigger was I was nearing my 30th birthday and I read The Price of a Dream by David Bornstein,
this
wonderful man, good friend, about Muhammad Yunus and microfinance. And I thought, well, maybe this is some way that I could apply some business acumen to trying to do something that I can become passionate about and find my purpose. So I left and I joined the Peace Corps thinking I'll just do it for 2 years and then I'll come back. And I never left. So it's been an amazing journey.
A lot happens when people approach their 30th birthday. I've heard many stories like that.
I would assume so. Yes, most certainly.
Yeah, let me close with this, Greg. It is so difficult to create change, changing our daily habits or our lives, much less a system or a community. With all the experience and wisdom you've been able to gain doing this work, what does it take to make change happen?
You know, I think about people that, you know, that I admire who just do tremendous work in this field. And certainly some of those qualities are, you know, like I talked about, you know, David Bornstein or so many others, is when people, you know, approach it with the intent of, how am I going to create change in communities? And that's their goal.
Mm-hmm.
That's their mission. I mean, certainly it's not about, again, just this constant self-sacrifice. You have to balance, obviously, you know your life and try to find that balance in your own life. But I think approaching it continuously with that in mind, being incredibly thoughtful. You know, this is really complex, hard work, and you have to continuously be thoughtful and think critically and be willing to beat up your own idea. And at the same time, ideally, having a good amount of humility. I think that, you know, in this journey, you know, as a social entrepreneur, let's say, oftentimes there can be this kind of hero worship thing that creeps in. And, you know, we need examples of success and we need to be able to point to those and learn from those. But you know, you're constantly questioning who you are and what you're doing and how you're doing it. So I think it's that understanding your mission. I think it's that being very thoughtful and thinking critically and being willing to change, and then trying to maintain some real humility around the work.
Well, Greg Van Kirk, the president of Social Entrepreneur Corps, thanks for being here this evening. Tell us about your website and what you have waiting there for visitors.
Yes, so we're going to have a new website, I think, when this airs. It's Project X. It's yourprojectx.com. And within there, you'll find Social Entrepreneur Corps and CareerX. Can, you know, link over to Community Empowerment Solutions, and then as well some of the consulting work that we do around the world supporting other organizations.
Well, it's about time you got an umbrella website.
Yeah, I know. It's a little, certainly not one of my strengths. Yeah.
Thanks, Greg. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you very much, Denver. I appreciate it.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
The Business of Giving can be heard every Sunday evening between 6 and 7 p.m. Eastern on AM 970 The Answer in New York and on iHeartRadio. You can follow us at Biz of Give on Twitter and at Facebook.com/Business of Giving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.